Hi, this is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214 to contribute to KBOO's $75,000 goal for our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, going now until December 31st.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
We know a KBOO membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season. Give the gift of supporting grassroots community media by making a donation during KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000. Your contribution will go towards your favorite music, news, and public affairs programming all year long. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
Hello everyone, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. On today's program, demystifying the settler colonial Thanksgiving Day holiday propaganda and more with a longtime Aquanaw Wampanoag historian and activist here on American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone fool in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching down the mountain. Because history ain't no mystery to me.
Been marching through the... Today on American Indian Airwaves, we go to the heart of the Aquanaw Wampanoag Nation in what is known as Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Our guest for the hour, Linda Coombs from the Aquanaw Wampanoag Nation, is an author and historian from the Wampanoag Tribe of Aquanaw and lives in the Wampanoag community of Mashpee on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Our guest has worked for over 30 years in the Wampanoag Indigenous Program of Plymouth Plantation, including 15 years as its associate director, and has worked 9 years at the Aquanaw Cultural Center. She is the recent author of the book Colonization and the Wampanoag Story, published in 2023. Today on American Indian Airwaves, Marcus Lopez from the Barbarino Band of the Chumash Nation and co-host and executive producer of American Indian Airwaves have the honor and pleasure to speak with Linda Coombs on Wampanoag Voices in Demystifying the Legacy of the Thanksgiving Day Holiday Propaganda. We begin today's interview asking Linda Combs to describe what was life like for the Wampanoag peoples before the colonial invasion began, and to unpack the demystification and propaganda surrounding the Thanksgiving Day holiday here on American Indian Airwaves.
The land area out here, or at least it was all forested. If you look at a map, there's like as much freshwater ponds and lakes and rivers and whatnot. You know, a lot of our territory is right on the ocean. And so our people were hunters, fishermen, farmers. You know, we've grown corn, beans, squash, and other vegetables for grown it for 1,000 years or more by the time the pilgrims landed in 1620. And we were foragers, and a lot of our people still do those things. You know, that was, you know, the type of lifestyle that we had, you know, back then. But in the records, in terms of the first Thanksgiving, which was in 1621, at that time it was not called the first Thanksgiving. So neither the pilgrims nor the Wampanoag people attendants knew it was that. It was actually a one-time event. In the historical record, one source is a Lort's Relation, written in 1622, and it describes the event. And the way that the English wrote, you know, back in those days was just one big, long swath of words and whatever they were saying with a semicolon every now and again. So it's in the middle of a big passage like that. And, you know, Massasoit, who was the sachem or the chief of our village of Pokanoket, which is where Warren and Bristol, Rhode Island are today, had come amongst them with 90 men, and they stayed for 3 days and feasted. And I think, you know, there's a lot of fabrication, a lot of assumptions, a lot of, well, they must have done this, they must have done that, but unless you know, put that into some sort of appropriate historical context, you're really making up history. One of those things, for example, is like the pilgrims invited the Indians. Well, in that passage, it doesn't say that. So you're kind of veering off the track and going into make-up land at that. It could be logical, and I say could be, to determine that Massasoit and, you know, other Wampanoag people came to that event because 6 months earlier in the spring, they had signed an agreement of mutual protection. Simply said that, you know, if any Narragansett Indians or other Indians attacked the pilgrims, the Wampanoags would help them, and vice versa, or pirates or whoever might be, you know, want to cause some sort of issue. And that's it. That's what's in the source. Massasoit and 90 men came among them. They stayed for 3 days and feasted. The Wampanoag people did go out and get 5 deer to provide to the feast, and that was it. That's the entire thing that's in, you know, the historical record. It became the first Thanksgiving 200 years later in the 19th century. There was a man named Alexander Young who wrote a book called Chronicles of the Pilgrim Fathers, and he basically took Mort's Relation and another volume and just updated the English language, the punctuation, you know, all of that sort of thing. So it was more readable to a modern eye. But he left the words just as they were, just verbatim. But at the bottom of the page, there was a little footnote that said, this was the first Thanksgiving. So that's when that whole thing started, you know. And that, you know, basically is how it's, you know, written down in the record.
And how does that get extended into this larger American mythology with President Abraham Lincoln and Sarah Hale?
Well, Lincoln, I don't know the exact wording, and I think it was like 1863. Uh-huh. Again, I'm not even sure about the exact year, but somewhere along in that time frame, Lincoln had made a proclamation in which he identified Fourth Thursday of November, the day of Thanksgiving, with a capital T, and I think it was like coming out of the Civil War, and the whole concept of Thanksgiving as unifying the country, one people, and all of that came to be used later in the 19th century to Americanize people immigrating from other countries, and it just it kind of just grew from that into the holiday that it's become today.
Linda, on your earlier comments many decades ago, you reflected on this whole quote-unquote holiday, and you were talking about Sarah Joseph Hale, the editor of the popular Good Days Later ladies book, that talked about and popularized this notion of turkey and cranberry and this notion of what they ate. And then finally, in 1858, Hale petitioned the president, like you indicated, that declared Thanksgiving a national holiday. And this notion of what they ate and this notion of Thanksgiving, why don't you describe, since you mentioned earlier during the decades, about not only this is a fantasy, but that Native people celebrated and gave thanks to many, many times a year and many actions during the ceremonies of not only Wampanoags, but Native people.
Yeah.
Unflesh that for us. Open that for us, for our listeners, about Native people and the real meaning of Thanksgiving within the context of Native culture.
Well, I mean, Thanksgiving was something which is absolutely part of everything we did. And we had, you know, ceremonies that were held throughout the year. Our Wampanoag New Year is in the spring, and we had a New Year ceremony, because in the spring, that's when the baby animals are born, you know, the leaves come out again, the flowers, you know, everything, the world is born anew. And we had planting ceremonies, we had different harvests, you know, green corn or green bean harvest in the fall, winter ceremonies. I mean, every time that people hunted or took any life, a fish, a plant, you know, it didn't have to be a big formal, if you will, ceremony. It could be as simple as offering tobacco or just, you know, having that mind to say a prayer and acknowledge that life and to give thanks for that life and understanding how that life is helping your life to continue, you know. So it was all of that. And so I'm not sure. I think, you know, the English people of the time period had a harvest celebration that they did. And I'm not sure why the holiday got to be called Thanksgiving. I guess it was, what was his name? Alexander Young there, who created that thought. And as far as turkey, I mean, you know, as far as I can see, turkeys, cranberries, squash, pumpkins, corn, green beans, you know, all of that is traditional Wampanoag foods. And not just Wampanoag, but anyone who lives in a wooded area like we do, you know. So there's that. So it's almost like our foods have been kind of appropriated into this dinner.
Yes, and you indicated there's an assumption that the Native people were invited, but nowhere in the passage that you mentioned does it say they were. And the idea that they sat down and lived happily ever after, well, that's untrue, you said. And then you said the relationship between the English and Wampanoags were very complex. Why don't you unpack that for us? What was the complexity that you're talking about?
Well, I think, you know, what one thing that gets left out of the whole Thanksgiving mythology story is that when the Pilgrims landed in Patuxent, or what they later renamed as Plymouth, in 1620, we had, you know, a huge epidemic that we refer to as the Great Dying had swept through the area. It started in southern Maine, came down the coast, and when it hit Exit or Plymouth, which is, you know, 50 miles south of Boston or what have you, it turned inland and stopped at Narragansett Bay. Within the area that it struck, there was a 75 to a 90% death rate. And we lost, like, entire villages, entire, you know, families, entire bodies of knowledge. You know, it was just, I don't think that we've recovered from it today, at least on the level of population. Because within the area that I had described for our, you know, Wampanoag homeland, we had 69 villages. And we always estimated that there's roughly 1,000 people per village. So to say that we had, you know, a nice round number of 70,000 people in our entire, you know, communities is hopefully in the ballpark. And when the Pilgrims settled, that, you know, this plague was so bad that people died within a couple of days of getting sick, and there was nobody to tend the sick because everybody was sick, and there's no one to bury the dead because everyone was dying, too sick, or they were already dead. And if there were any survivors, they moved out. They just left and went to another village because, you know, it was always family, relatives, you know. But Patuxent was one place that was hit very hard, and we just guesstimate that when the pilgrims came in, they were literally having to sweep aside bones to build that village, okay? And for years, when I worked at Plymouth Plantation, which is an outdoor living history museum, I mean, for years in the early days, the 70s and 80s into the 90s, you know, we were interpreting that this plague, this epidemic was inadvertent. And, you know, I was recently reviewing some of the sources, and there's a passage from John Smith, who was, you know, I'm sure you've heard of him, an explorer. And he was talking about a fishing expedition, because people, Europeans were coming over here for like 100 years right. to fish. Fish, trade, explore, before they actually settled, anybody settled in 1620. And so there's one fishing expedition that was off the coast of Maine, and the passage talked about the ship left, you know, to go back to Europe, but these two men had escaped. And all of a sudden that word kind of hit me right between the eyes. I'm thinking, why would these two Frenchmen or Englishmen, whoever they were, escape and to go live with people they considered savages, as opposed to staying on the ship and going home to their own families? You know, that just didn't make any sense to me. And then they're talking about one guy died right away, and the other guy was sick, but he lived, and he later, you know, learned the language of the people up there and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, that one guy died right away, so they didn't escape. They were put off the ship because they were sick. This is what I'm thinking. I'm not saying it's fact. This is just my kind of following the logic here. They put him off the ship because, you know, the guy was sick. And was this the guy that started this epidemic? I can't say that for sure. I can't say it at all. But, you know, it's kind of walking like a duck. You know what I mean?
Ian, we want to remind listeners you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Linda Combs from the Aquanaw Wampanoag Nation. She's based out of the Wampanoag community of Mashpee in what is known as Cape Cod, Massachusetts. We're speaking on Wampanoag Voices in Demystifying the Legacy of the Thanksgiving Day Holiday Propaganda here on American Indian Airwaves. And now back to the interview.
And then the other guy learned the language, and he starts communicating with the native people of the area, and it doesn't name who they were. But right away, he's trying to talk to them about religion and Christianity and all of this stuff. And that man felt that these native people were deriding him, like making fun of him. Because, of course, they have their own way of worshiping and spirituality and whatnot. And it got to a point where he's like, well, you know, if you don't, and I'm, this is not a direct quote, I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, if you don't convert to, you know, our God, our God has a way to wipe you all off the face of the earth. Well, isn't that funny that a couple of years later, that's exactly what happened. And I have to look at stuff like that and just really consider it. Because I know that disease was used all over the place to just kill people to clear the land. And other writers subsequently say that. The land was cleared for a better people, meaning the Europeans.
Linda, that was pretty much the same kind of methodology over here in the West Coast in California and within the Southwest. The usage of not only of disease, but yet of their... of their particular ideology and religious thought,
right.
You know, so that was happening back then in the East Coast around 1620s, and you talked about that village, but within that, there's a myth also about Tisquantu, or also about the area in which you said that they went in, the pilgrims went in. And then I would like to talk about a little bit about the and we're getting to the how the Wampanoag feasts, but then and then they already established the notion that if the first gathering was a peace and friendship agreement was made between Mascariot and Miles Standish, which later on he turned out to be a real scoundrel, if you will, being conservative on that. But yet, talk about Squanto or Tisquantum. You know, what's his relationship with this story? Because there's a lot of children's book talk about that and whatnot. Please talk about that to our listeners.
Okay. Well, this great dying, this huge epidemic, that happened between 1616 and 1618, which is why I say when the pilgrims landed in 1620, they were literally sweeping away bones to build their houses and whatnot. Squanto, or Tisquantum, was from the village of Patuxet, okay? And he, along with 26 others, some from Patuxet, some from Nauset on Cape Cod, which is now the town of Eastham area, they were kidnapped to be, you know, by the English, by English people, to be taken back to England or Spain and sold into slavery, okay? And they were either sold into slavery or...
I don't want to interrupt you, but I think that's an important point because slavery was a mechanism and where... It was first established that Native people were turned into slaves. Is that not correct?
That is absolutely correct. And in those days...
I'm sorry to interrupt you in your story about Squanto, though. Continue, please.
Yeah, well, I'll get to the larger story of slavery. In Squanto, he was taken in 1614. So that's 2 years before this epidemic happened. But... The whole, like I said, there were ships going back and forth for 100 years. They were exploring, trading, fishing, and slaving, you know. And so Squanto and his 26, relatives were taken to Spain to be sold into slavery. Squanto somehow made his escape from there and got back to England. He was taken in by a certain group of monks and thereby avoided the fate of being a slave. And he was over there for 5 years. And I know that he made at least one voyage back. I'm not sure what year. They went to like Labrador. And for some reason, the ship couldn't come further south to bring him back home to Patuxet. And they went back to England. And as it ended up, he was gone for 5 years and was returned home by Thomas Hunt in 1619. So when he had come home to Patuxet, the plague had already gone through there. He gets off the ship and he's looking at broken down houses, overgrown cornfields, and bones. His entire family was gone. And then the Pilgrim Land, and where Squanto spoke English, you know, they kind of latched onto him right away because they were wanting to, you know, communicate with the Wampanoag people, and he became their interpreter, or their tongue, as they referred to him as. And he did show them how to plant corn and the other vegetables, because they were not sure that European vegetables would grow here, but they knew that corn would, because it had been. And so, you know, and so that part is true, but that was like... I mean, it doesn't even say who exactly he showed how to plant the corn, because in English culture, the men were farmers and the women were not as much, which is different from our culture. The women were the farmers, so there's that. And then he seemed to cause a lot of, you know, issues between Massasoit. Massasoit, that's actually a title and not a person's name. It means great leader. The person that title usually refers to, as far as this story is concerned, is a man named Usamequin. Mm-hmm. He was the sachem, or the chief, of the village of Poconoket, which, as I mentioned, was in Warren in Bristol, Rhode Island, which is way over on the western boundary of Wampanoag country, if you will. And I think because of the devastation of the plague and the loss of so many entire villages, including their leadership, that is why Massasoit was chosen, because of the man that he was. he was very much loved and respected by, you know, Wampanoag people, that he was chosen to come to Plymouth and, you know, see what the English were about. And as I said, you know, he was the one who agreed to this treaty of mutual protection. I always, you know, a lot of times people want to say, oh, they had a peace treaty. No, it wasn't a peace treaty, because that has so much baggage with it, such a stereotype, that meaning that it usually means that, oh, they had a peace treaty so the Indians aren't going to fight us and they don't mind that we've come here to take their land and everything that goes along with that. And it wasn't. Their agreement had to do with their situation. And to make an agreement like that was a very common thing for Wampanoag people in the way that we treat it with other people, you know, whether it was other tribes or other villages, you know, depending on what the situation was. So Massasoit is doing something that's pretty typical. The only thing that wasn't typical was that he was doing it with English people and not other native people, because they're about 5 minutes into that agreement and the English had already violated it. As I said, you know, the English were afraid of being attacked by other Indian people, by pirates or whomever else might, you know, be around that would cause them harm. And they signed this treaty together of mutual, which I've come to call, you know, an alliance of mutual protection. So,
Linda, you, Marcus brought up slavery and you know, part of this mythology that really has centered and is part of American civic identity, if you will. And in any mythology, besides the propaganda, and part of that propaganda is erasure. And so when we think of, you know, the institution of slavery before, you know, besides disease, as you've shared with our listeners, that the institution of slavery had been around for decades. And that also shapes, you know, what's happening back home before, you know, the arrival, quote unquote, of the pilgrims who were trying to get to the Virginia colony. And I was wondering, talk about slavery and how important it is to understand slavery, because so oftentimes for Americans, it gets associated with the enslavement of Afro-Indigenous peoples, when in fact, more Native American men in particular were enslaved and, to put it crassly, exported than the importation, if you will, of Afro-Indigenous peoples. Talk about that for our listeners, please.
Well, by 1620, and I'm not completely knowledgeable about this, I can give you some basics. Mm-hmm. But by 1620, the Atlantic slave trade triangle was firmly established. That was Boston, Mass. No, it wasn't either. But it was this area. Boston hadn't been established till 1630. Told you I wasn't good at math, right? But there was, you know, it was this area, Europe, and the Caribbean. Because they already had, English people were already in the Caribbean, with, you know, establishing sugar plantations, colonizing down there. They're all about colonizing, which is all about building empire, all about making money to fund and sustain those empires. And in this area, they were literally rounding up men from whatever tribes they came across and shipping down to the Caribbean to work on the sugar plantations, as opposed to just enslaving people here, because if people were to stay here in their own homeland, they could much more easily escape because they knew the landscape where the English people didn't. So the solution to that problem is to just get rid of the people, put them someplace where they don't know where they are. Same thinking applies when you bring African people and bring them up this area, or whether you bring the African people and put them on the Caribbean islands. There's less chance of them running away because they don't know the land, you know. And as I said, that whole process, you know, was in full swing as of by 1620. You know, and that was to fund the establishment of colonies here, or at least partly. Because Plymouth Colony was established, of course, in 1620. Mass Bay Colony or Boston was established in 1630, and slavery was a cornerstone of the establishment of this country. I mean, that's, yeah. You know. And throughout the 17th century, you know, I think that type of slavery sort of morphed into or gained another arm, I'm not sure which way that went, to include indentured servitude. Indenture was something that Europeans did with their own children, but it's like kind of like going to school or something, because you might indenture to a blacksmith at the age of 8, and you get released from indenture when you're 18 and you've achieved a skill that you can now go out and make your living. But with people here, it was something that just, it didn't have any end date like that, you know. And people, you know, the native people, particularly native women, were brutalized and raped. And this was a system. You know, a lot of times people want to assign it to some random incident, you know, this one person, but it was not that. It was a system, and it was throughout like southern New England. Because there are stories coming from like the Pequots and, you know, in Connecticut and, you know, and all throughout Massachusetts and Narragansett and Rhode Island. So it was a total system aimed at, number one, dominating the indigenous people, but then using their labor to sustain their colonial enterprises to make money.
And that concludes part one of our two-part interview here on American Indian Airwaves. We've been speaking with Linda Combs from the Aquanaut Wampanoag Nation, who is a longtime educator, author, and historian based out of Mashpee in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Our guest has worked for over 30 years in the Wampanoag Indigenous Program of Plymouth Plantation, including 15 years as its associate director, and has worked 9 years at the Aquanaut Cultural Center, and is the recent author of the book, Colonization and the Wampanoag Story. She joins us for the hour on Wampanoag Voices in demystifying the legacy of the Thanksgiving Day holiday propaganda here on American Indian Airwaves. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back with part two of our interview here on American Indian Airwaves.
To those who search and never find, to those that turn away the so-called non-accepted, to those that bring us together, and to those living outside, keeping touch, the voice for many.
To those that make it back to live and fight the struggles of their people, to those that give up and those who do not care, to those who abuse themselves and others, and those who revive again, to those who are physically, mentally, or spiritually incapable by accident or by birth, to those who seek strength in our spirituality and ways of life, and those who exploit it, even our own. To those who fall for the lies and join the dividing lines that keep us fighting amongst each other.
To the outsiders who step in, good or bad, and those of us who don't know better. To the leaders and prisoners of war, politics, crime, race, and religion, innocent or guilty.
To the young, the old, the living, and the dead. To our brothers and sisters and all living things across Mother Earth, and her beauty we've destroyed and denied the honor that the Creator has given each individual.
The truth that lies in our hearts, all my relations.
Oil, arms, and drugs. 1 a million, 2 a million. Oil, arms, and drugs.
The song All My Relations by Eulalie here on American Indian Airwaves. In the second half of today's program, we go back to part two of our interview with Linda Combs from the Aquinaw Wampanoag Nation. She's based out of the Wampanoag community of Mashpee on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Our guest is an author and historian. She's worked for over 30 years in the Wampanoag Indigenous Program of Plymouth Plantation, including 15 years as its associate director, and she worked 9 years at the Aquinaw Cultural Center. She's the recent author of the book Colonization and the Wampanoag Story, published in 2023. Today on American Indian Airwaves, Marcus Lopez of the Barbarino Band of the Chumash Nation and co-host and executive producer of American Indian Airwaves and myself have the honor to speak with Linda Combs on Wampanoag Voices in Demystifying the Legacy of the Thanksgiving Day Holiday Propaganda. And now part two of our interview here on American Indian Airwaves.
Yes, Linda, I think it's leading to this question of Thanksgiving. I call it Thanksgiving. They take and they take and they take. The pilgrims and also the birth of this country is a taking country, you might say, from the native peoples. Talk about the ruthless war of extermination. And this person by the name Miles Standish, that I know you know about him, but talk about that. So when I read about this man and about this effort of extermination, it just so reminded me of the genocide of California Indians, number one.
And secondly,
this question of racism, of colonialism, of imperialism, of the invaders, the colonial settler society, that you mentioned that in some of your books. But yet this question of how they did it, and I was just in shock. And I reading of many, many books and many, many programs, American Indian Airwaves, Miles Standish is a pallbearer, you might say, of this brutality, murder, rape, insanity that the Europeans brought. Talk about this individual for us.
Yeah, I know a little bit about him, of course, because he came on the Mayflower. He was a military leader by trade, his career, and I forget what wars or whatever he was in back in England. But, you know, when he was here, there were two leaders up in what is now Weymouth, Massachusetts, which is a little bit south of Boston. And he ended up murdering these two men, Pexawatt, and I can't remember the other man's name. But he stabbed them and murdered them. They were sort of lured into someone's house, and then, you know, and Standish ended up killing them, and he gained a reputation as an Indian killer thereby. And I don't know too much more about his activities beyond that point, because that was like 1623. But he had that reputation of being an Indian killer from that. And the only thing I can say, you know, When I worked at Plymouth Plantation, and I'm going back like 30 years now, in the Pilgrim Village, they used to do what we call a first-person style of interpretation. So people would play the role of Miles Standish or, you know, John Billington or Stephen Hopkins or Miles Standish. And during the wintertime when the museum was closed, some of the people worked in the education department. They go out and talk about, we did that as well. So they were either getting, you know, pilgrim information or Wampanoag. And there was one of the role players of Miles Standish who came to a fifth grade in the Mashpee schools, Mashpee being still the largest of our three remaining Wampanoag communities today. Probably back then they may have had 2,000, 2,500 people, I'm not sure. Mashpee was one of our original villages of the original 69 I was mentioning earlier. It was made into a reservation around 1660, and it kind of went back and forth between that status and that of a self-governing status up until 1870. So it was like a reservation type of thing for 200 years. And in 1870, it was incorporated as a town. And up until about the 1960s or 70s, you know, I mean, I moved to Mashpee in the 1970s. And at that time, I was told by people my own age in their 20s that it was unusual to see a white person walking down the street because it was just primarily Mashpee folks. But in that time, you know, because Mashpee had been a reservation, it was undeveloped. It was all woods and forest, you know, clean water, the whole thing. And it became, therefore, prime real estate. Other people came in, started developing because anyone could go into a town and buy and sell land. And I think in the 70s, the tribe made up some 40% of the town's population. The town has grown. The tribe's grown. The Mashpee tribe is like 3,300 people, which is more than in the 70s. But the rest of the town has grown so exponentially that the tribe makes up 4% of the town's population. So they've lost a lot of... Can you tell me the original question?
You're on track. You went... Because I was talking about this Miles Standish and...
Oh, yes.
And the... No, right. Because the evolution of the community is just as important as to tell the truth, not only about the community that they're still here, that they're not disappearing, you know, like many of the North American immigrants that came from, and the majority of American public don't understand that Native people are still here. So your story is very important, that the resilience and the tenacity of the people. So your involvement and even the discussion about it is so important. That going back to this individual, and the reason I bring up his name is not because I want to glorify him. On the contrary,
I'm not trying to glorify him.
I know you're not, but the history kind of does, you know. And these people, the pilgrims, and the military leaders and what they did that led up to precipitated to the King Philip's War, which is the most, it's like barbarism in its true form of what the pilgrims did to the native peoples within the eastern coast. And this Standish, Miles Standish, beheaded the Indian man named Witwatmop, you know. And this,
yes, Witwatmop.
Yes, and this, they beheaded a man, and not only did they cut him up, but they displayed his head in the village, in the township.
Okay.
I mean, and this is the brutality that I want to share about this thanksgiving, is that they just completely, was the extermination process that you talked about, and about leading up to King Philip's War. Talk about King Philip's War. What is that's a fancy name for extermination. Talk about that for us for a second.
Okay. Well, let me finish my story that I was forgetting, if I could.
Go ahead.
I was talking about the role player 30 years ago who went into a classroom in the Mashpee schools. This is a native town. And in that classroom, there were two young Wampanoag girls, 10 years old. And I don't know if this role player knew about them specifically being in that class, but he certainly knew he was going into an Indian town and that there was a chance of Native children being in whatever classroom he was going into. Because during his presentation, he went in as Miles Standish, but he framed... Miles Standish, and these were his words. He said that Miles Standish, was an Indian killer, and expounded upon that. And these two children, these two little girls, were so upset. They go home and they tell their parents,
The next thing I know, one of the parents drove to Plymouth, from Mashpee to Plymouth, like 30 miles. She drives 30 miles, comes and finds me. I didn't even know this went on, because I didn't work on the Pilgrim side of the museum, you know. But, you know, here she is and crying in front of me, talking about what this man had said to her daughter and the other girl. And I'm like, oh, my goodness gracious. So I went and found my boss and the woman who was the program manager in the Pilgrim Village and informed them of what had happened. And I was very fortunate to work with people who were very understanding of these issues, because they took this role player, sat him down and talked to him. He wasn't getting it. He didn't see where he had done anything wrong. And my point in saying that is, that's how deep this stuff goes. He's being told that he has so upset these two young children, and it didn't faze him. So what happened to him was that he no longer got to portray Miles Standish, summer, winter, Pilgrim Village, schools, nowhere. And so at least there was that. And, you know, and then I, you know, was dealing with the parents, which was fine, because that was part of my role, you know, and in working with my own community, you know, in this job. But it just, I think we were all just very shocked by the fact that this man just didn't get this. And was just, it's one thing to role play, you know, and to talk about what actually happened in history. And yes, Miles Standish was an actual person, but he was a military person, and he did kill these two Wampanoag men and earned the reputation as Indian killer. Then you got to watch who's in your audience and be, you know, have some finesse, have some sensibility, some sensitivity as to how you're going to present the information, because you're there to educate, not to, you know, hurt children. So that's my rant for the day. So now we can move on to King Philip's War, I guess. You know, when I worked at Plymouth, people used to ask me, what caused King Philip's War? And especially the church, I'm like, I didn't know this. And what incident may have, you know, all of a sudden made people want to have a war.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Linda Combs from the Aquanaw Wampanoag Nation. She's based out of the Wampanoag community of Mashpee in what is known as Cape Cod, Massachusetts. We're speaking on Wampanoag voices in demystifying the legacy of the Thanksgiving Day holiday propaganda here on American Indian Airwaves. And now back to the interview.
And because you hear stuff about some Indian people killed somebody's cow, and that was the last straw, and, you know, there's other things like that, which is just, I mean, I don't know if they killed the cow or not, but to say that that's what started the war is just ludicrous. What started the war, that began in the 16th, 17th century, even before the Pilgrims landed, when they were coming over here and overfishing, harvesting lumber, fur trade, over-harvesting furs, you know, and then settling, taking more land, all the resources of the land, removing us in one way or another from our land, from our families, you know, imposing Christianity, imposing a European educational system, creating laws that prevented us from practicing our ceremonies or, you know, having land, you know, that's a big one. Just colonization is such a myriad of processes that are so devastating, you know. And I've also had people say, well, you know, there was 50 years of peace between 1620 and 1675 when the war broke out. And I'm like, okay, maybe there was no outright fighting, but when you are imposing Christianity and the rule of it is convert or die, when you think that someone has to be changed to be like you, that is not peace. Those are the terms of war, you know. So by the time King Philip's War happened, now it's 1675, throughout the 17th century, there'd been an epidemic a decade. Our numbers declined because we didn't have the immunity. English people died from these diseases as well, but not the numbers that we did. Plus, there were more people coming from Europe by the boatload, so that we were just outnumbered. So Philip was going around to all the tribes in the area, you know, Narragansett, Nipmuc, Mohegan, Pequot, even went as far as Mohawk. And not everyone wanted to join his efforts, but many did. But it was almost like it was too little too late. But for a while, we were winning. And we were winning because we knew the landscape. We knew how to move through the landscape without being heard, without being seen. And the English were out there with red coats marching in a line and wondered why they got shot, you know. And I think a turning point came when, and I can't remember who it was, but he was like, well, we got to learn to fight like they do because we're not getting anywhere. And they did. They learned how to move silently. They you know, they observed what we were doing and followed that and learned those things. And that whole process, number one, it enabled them to get ahead in the war. And it also, that's how, like, Rogers Rangers, the Texas Rangers, I don't know if all states have a group of Rangers as law enforcement or whatever, but that's how that all started, you know. And we just got tsunamied. We had did not have the numbers of people to, and we were being chased all over the landscape, and so we didn't have time to grow corn. We didn't have time to tan hides to make our clothing and, or, you know, any of that stuff. So, yeah, long story short, the war didn't go our way.
You might say, Linda, that they had the resources and the cultural war was different from Europeans and Native people, first of all. Off the start, the war was a whole different phenomena for Native people, the way the English and the way the Europeans fought. Fast forward now, because we can go on for a long time, but I know you have other things to do. You're a very busy person. We're very fortunate to have you. Talk about Frank James. Talk about 1970s. Fast forward to this and his so-called speech.
Well, Frank James was an Aquinnah Wampanoag man, and was my cousin, actually. And he lived not on Martha's Vineyard, but he lived in Chatham, which is further down Cape Cod. And he was a music teacher in the high school in East Ham or Orleans, which is also, you know, other towns down the Cape, and was a trumpet player by trade. Also, you know, he was involved when we had our land suit and during the whole process before Aquinnah got, you know, our federal recognition in 1987. He was involved with all of that, very active like that. And every 25 years, the town of Plymouth has some sort of a celebration, small or large, you know, depending on the year, to celebrate the landing of the Mayflower. And in 1970, that was a big one because that was the 350th anniversary. And, you know, they wanted to include the Indians, but they wanted, you know, the happy story of happy pilgrims and Indians getting along and sharing turkey gravy recipes or whatever we were supposed to have done. And so they asked Frank to give a speech. So Frank writes a speech, and they wanted to see it before he gave it. And he was telling the truth of history of how we lost land and people and the whole thing. And they would not let him give that speech. Okay, and so he and it wasn't just Frank, but there were other people. There's a man named Everett Whedon, or Tall Oak. He was known as Tall Oak, who was Wampanoag and Pequot. There's a Cherokee man that still lives here. James Frazier lives somewhere in the Boston area. And then were others. There's a Narragansett man, William Wilcox, so they called him Big Toe, and Frank, who had the idea to start the day of mourning. So really the whole censorship of Frank's speech just added fuel to the fire that was already going for the day of mourning. But Frank was sort of the moderator, you know, of the day's events. And I mean, I was like 20 years old back then, and I just remember being in Plymouth. I think it was my first time ever in Plymouth, and just seeing a sea of people, you know, in the street up on Coles Hill with the statue of Massasoit is, because that's where everyone always gathers. And down the hill and across the street is the portico that shelters Plymouth Rock. The portico being more impressive than the rock itself, I might add. And it's just this incredible amount of people. And a lot of the AIM guys were there. There was Russell Means, Dennis Banks, John Trudell, Eddie Benton, Clyde and Vernon Belcourt. Mm. So it was quite a thing. And, you know, and everyone's giving speeches. Some of the folks climbed the Mayflower, which was, it's across the street from Coles Hill and just a little bit down from where the rock is. And in those days, they had mannequins on the ship. And so they were climbing the masts of the ship. They took the mannequin of Captain Jones, who was the captain that sailed the ship over with the Pilgrims on it in 1620. He went over the side. But being a mannequin, I guess he was made of wood, so he floated, so that was okay, you know. And afterwards, I think there was also some of those folks went down to Plantation, where they had a table with food and turkey and all the rest of it, and they overturned the table, and it was just quite a day, you know. And then we all gathered, you know, at a location afterwards and ate together, and it was really spectacular. And
now,
then
Linda,
you know,
now Linda, yeah. on that note, on the Wamsutta, his native name they went by, he said the long speech, and a lot of stuff was very profound. People need to go in and see what that speech is. We didn't have time in this discussion. But one of the things he said, and you resonate, your spirit resonate with this. He said, our spirit refuses to die. And you're an example of that. Your spirit refused to die. Any last words to our listeners about this Thanksgiving, so-called Thanksgiving?
Couple things. In reference to Frank's speech, it's easily found online nowadays, I think. And then, I think as far as non-Native people, you know, I don't think anybody has a problem with family getting together and having a meal and reflecting, but I think that what has become the holiday of Thanksgiving has been done at the expense of the indigenous people of this country. And that is something that should also be reflected on and remembered, or perhaps take it a step further and do something that will affect how one would celebrate that holiday. Mm-hmm. To just ignore the history of this country and how it was established is wrong.
The moment of silence is over.
And that concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. We were speaking with Linda Combs from the Aquanaut Wampanoag Nation on Wampanoag Voices in Demystifying the Legacy of the Thanksgiving Day Holiday Propaganda here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest for the hour, Linda Combs. A special thank you to our musical guest, Aragon Star, Kupa Aina, Eulalie, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
Wearing their souls on the thread. The moment of silence is over. And for the innocent, you can't justify why your freedom manifests on their graves. And the blood never comes clean from their guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains.
KBOO Portland.
Ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon.